employee, all persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention to the court is now sitting. God save the United States and Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 053131, United States of America versus Wilbert S. Brody, a.k.a. Brody Wilson, Anthony Brody, appellant. Mr. Kramer for appellant, Mr. Mallory, appellate.
Mr. Kramer, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Well, I'm amicus for Mr. Brody and have addressed only certain issues in my brief. As I said, I don't intend that to be any reflection on the issues he's raised in his briefs, and I am familiar with the issues he's raised in his briefs if there are any questions on those, and I may be able to answer questions about the issues he's raised. The issues I have raised are that there were two fundamental flaws in Mr. Brody's trial and two fundamental flaws in his sentencing. The first error occurred when the district court, after an objection later in the argument, stopped the defense lawyer's closing argument and instructed the jury that they were to disregard the closing argument, which was perfectly proper, as in the Lawson case, talking about the lack of evidence to corroborate Ms. Harper's story about when she first told the government about Mr. Brody, first mentioned Mr. Brody's name. The government objected, and there was a bench conference at which there was a discussion about what to do. The district judge then instructed the jury that they should disregard the argument, about whether she said this in November 1st, and that the argument was struck, and that the only evidence they had before you was that she mentioned his name. This, of course, undermined completely the attack on her credibility that was being put forth by the defense lawyer in closing argument.
But didn't Judge Hubel give the standard instruction that you may believe or disbelieve any portion? In other words, when she said the only evidence you have before you is Ms. Harper's statement, she wasn't saying, and therefore that's the only thing you can believe.
She didn't add that, but she struck the argument that he was making about there's nothing to corroborate that, so there was no, it shouldn't be believed. She struck that argument, told them to disregard it, and then told them that the only evidence they had is that she said she mentioned it in November 1st.
But wasn't that in connection with, I mean, she strikes it because he's leaving the impression that because of the delay in the trial, there's something wrong with what she said so many years ago.
Well, I think that's an incorrect premise, first of all. He said this sentence at the beginning of that portion of the argument. He said, why are we here? Everything else in that paragraph, the first sentence was, if she brought it up, why are we trying this case in 2005? But there was no objection at that point. He then went on to talk about there's no evidence to corroborate, not mentioning the delay at all. He said, what evidence did they show you that she mentioned it? He's an experienced prosecutor. He introduced all these exhibits, no document to support this. And then there's an objection with no grounds stated. Then they go up to the bench, and the district court takes it from there. The prosecutor says nothing. And the district court takes it and says this is an improper argument about the delay. And it doesn't even allow the defense lawyer to say anything.
But why do you say? I was wondering about the defense lawyer doesn't say anything. When you say doesn't allow, there's plenty of back and forth between the court and the prosecutor. There's no indication that the court said to the defense lawyer, I don't want to hear from you or anything. The defense lawyer, it seems like the defense lawyer is not disagreeing that this was what the problem was.
Well, there's another way to look at it, which was the defense lawyer was shut out of this dialogue between the district court and the judge. I don't think there's any support for your theory in the sense that there's nothing he said that indicated any agreement.
If you were the defense lawyer, the first thing when the court said this, you would have said, well, that's not what I'm trying to say, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say is lack of corroboration. That's what you would have said. But the defense lawyer, if that were correct, but that's not what the defense lawyer says. The defense lawyer doesn't say anything except at one point to correct the dates. And that sounds like, I mean, there are a number of possible answers to this, but the failure to do that sounds like the defense lawyer is not disagreeing that that's what the problem was.
Why don't
we have a plain error question here? That is, the district court struck this and gave an instruction, and the defense counsel didn't at any moment disagree.
Well, I don't think it's plain error, and certainly the government hasn't argued that in their brief, that this is a plain error, because of when a district judge shuts off a closing argument like this, I don't think you have to voice an objection. It's clear he wanted to make the argument, and she shut him down. It became a little bizarre when the prosecutor asked the judge, how do we cure that? It was almost like the roles were reversed. The judge was in there taking over for the prosecutor, and the prosecutor said, usually the court would ask, how do we cure that, and ask the prosecutor for a suggestion. The prosecutor asked the judge, how do we cure that? And the judge says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm striking everything about this. So first of all, I don't think it's plain error, like I said, and the government hasn't argued that. There's no law out there I know of that says when a closing argument's interrupted by an objection, although no grounds were stated here. That's another thing. No grounds were stated for the objection. They get up to the bench, and the district court just goes off on this. The objection was not made when he said, why are we trying the case? So I don't know of any law that requires the defendant to say, no, this is what I was trying to say to overcome plain error review, and that's certainly not what the government has argued.
The review is abuse of discretion.
Yes. Although there's no facts in dispute. It's simply a legal issue here. The legal issue is, was this argument improper?
The court thought that what the problem was a statement about the timing, and the defense counsel didn't take the opportunity to explain that that's not what I was trying to get at. Doesn't that go to abuse of whether discretion is abused or not
This case seems to me to be indistinguishable from Lawson, where the lawyer was arguing about the absence of evidence, and so it is an abuse of discretion under Lawson, because the lawyer was arguing about an absence of evidence to corroborate her story, her credibility being crucial from the defense standpoint for this case, because she's the only one who connected Mr. Brody saying that he had some kind of fraudulent intent. No other witness said what Mr. Brody had said with respect to any of these transactions, or talked about that he directed them to do anything. That he asked them to do anything. So this was really the crucial witness, and destroying her credibility was crucial. And when the district judge cut off this perfectly proper attack on her credibility in closing, and then went a step further and said, you have this evidence, even though it was evidence that was disputed by the defense properly, that she shouldn't be believed when she said this. In fact, the FBI agent had testified that we were investigating Mr. Brody, and it didn't have to do with the fact that we were investigating these other people. So in a sense, there was some corroboration, in fact, for the defense argument. Which leads me to the next point, the Brady issue. When the government disclosed that Ms. Harper, after trial, even though the government had this information a year before trial, the FBI had it, and the FBI case agent actually had the information during trial, they didn't disclose to the defense until after trial that Ms. Harper had been involved in as a loan officer getting fraudulent loan application for her niece her employment as the loan officer. This was while she was cooperating. You got to remember, at the trial, the government portrayed her, especially on redirect testimony, that she had had this epiphany and had decided to come forward and be truthful. And on redirect, they kept saying, she said, I'm telling the truth now. She said at one point, I want a wrong or right. But she said, I'm telling the truth. I'm telling the truth. I'm telling the truth. This is all behind me. I'm telling the truth. At the same time, she's concealing from the government, and the government concealing from the defense, that she had submitted a false loan application as a loan officer. She came off at trial as, I'm this simple appraiser, and although I've done hundreds of fraudulent appraisals, I'm just an appraiser. I'm not a loan officer.
And the Carteret incident?
The Carteret incident.
I know what it says in the transcript. What was the defense told about that before?
There's nothing in the record of which I'm aware that indicates how the defense became aware of this. I'm not certain of how.
There is a statement in the government's response to the motion for new trial. The government says that it had disclosed the Carteret incident before trial to the defense.
I don't know the details of what was disclosed.
We don't know whether the defense counsel knew of the false statements as a loan officer, then?
I'm sorry?
Well, the government's argument is that Carteret is the same kind of lie that you're talking about. That is, a lie not as an appraiser, but as a loan officer, right?
Right, but that is not apparent. That
not apparent
may or may not be, but that's not what the transcript says.
The transcript shows an ineffective cross-examination by the defense counsel who may let her go too early. But it doesn't show whether the defense counsel had available what would be necessary to have done an effective cross-examination.
And I think you're right in one sense, yes, but it doesn't matter for the Brady claim in the sense of it was this different evidence that the jury didn't see.
Well, but if it's the same, if there are two equivalent lies, for example, and the government gives you one and not the other, believe me, I understand why they should have given you both, but we're talking about whether the second one becomes cumulative or not. If you had one and you didn't use it, that doesn't suggest that the second one is any more material.
Well, let me put it
any well doesn't suggest you'd have been able to use the second one well.
Right. Let me answer it this way. In the government's brief, they argued that this transcript supported that she was the loan officer and that she committed some fraudulent activity. They don't say that the information that was given, they don't argue that the information that was given.
You don't know what information was given?
I don't. And they don't argue that in their brief, that sufficed. And they argue solely that this transcript was of the same kind of material as the undisclosed Brady material. So, and again, cumulative error with the cutoff of the closing argument. Harper's credibility was crucial to the defense in this case, absolutely crucial.
Can you switch to the sentencing?
Yes, I wanted to talk, first thing I want to do is apologize to the court. There's a case mentioned in my brief, Quigley, that's mentioned in my brief, that's not mentioned at all in the government's brief, that I think is, if anything, more on point as to why there should not be a four-point. It's 373 Fed Third, page 133 from this circuit. And this is a flipping scheme, too. And in that case, the defendant was a real estate agent. She arranged the buyers. She got them. She showed them how to fill out false applications. She got a higher price for the land by hiring the appraisers who would value the land at an inflated cost. They couldn't qualify for mortgages, so she helped them qualify for mortgages. By submitting fraudulent documents. She got them false income records, misrepresenting their ability to pay, and was clearly the in charge of this scheme, this whole scheme.
Again, about the standard of review on that one. So in looking over this sentencing hearing, it appears that the only objection relates to the number, not to the control over those who are within that number.
Well, again, the government doesn't argue plain error on that. They say that the only failure to object was to the specificity of the government's finding.
That's right. But the court has to say about control certainly has something to do with whether somebody's objecting to the question of control.
Well, there's two things. It's not just what the court has to say, but what evidence there was of control.
I understand that, but you were making both arguments.
Both arguments, yes.
So as to the first argument, it's correct, isn't it, that the objection below was to the number, not to the control.
The district court seemed to think it encompassed the whole thing because the district court went through the whole analysis, as did the government.
I've looked at all the pleadings. I don't see a pleading in which the defense counsel makes an objection to anything other than numbers. Is that right?
There's reference to a pleading that's not in the record for some reason, that's not there, period.
Filed by the defendant.
Attached, in fact,
attached to the brief.
Mr. Brody refers to it.
Well, he attaches it to his supplemental.
Right, he attaches it to one of his briefs.
But there's nothing else, is there?
No, but there was discussion of the sentencing. The district court clearly thought it was encompassed because.
So then all we have to look at is what was said in the sentencing.
Right, although the district court, the government admitted to the district court that there had to be control of others at page 173 of the.
Well, there's no question it has to be control. The question is whether the defendant is raising a problem about that or about the other question. And I don't see anything where the defendant questions control, only the number. Now, I agree with you, there still has to be evidence. But with respect to how much the court has to say about this, it should depend.
I think you're right in the sense that the much stronger argument is that there's absolutely no evidence that they controlled anybody. If you look at Quigley, the government argued that she controlled the property buyers because she recruited them and told them how to trick the FHA into insuring their loans. She controlled the appraisers as she told them the false appraisal value to employ and solicited the appraisers in that case. Much more than Mr. Brody did in this case. The Court of Appeals says there is simply no evidence that she quickly exercised control over any of the other participants in this scheme. All persons receiving the enhancement must exercise some control. There has to be some hierarchy with managerial or supervisory authority of some sort, and that she had no superior relationship with the persons who were purportedly her subordinates. The district court failed to require any proof that Quigley was hierarchically superior to her co-conspirators. That's exactly this case.
Did she keep the fruits like Mr. Brody did?
Yes. The evidence was that she made far more money. The evidence in this case, there was evidence of how much Mr. Brody.
That was a plea agreement, Quigley, right? So there wasn't a trial.
Right, but she gave quite a bit of information in the record. There was trials, I think, of other. People in Quigley that the district court had presided over.
Answer my question about the fruits.
I'm sorry, I forgot it already. I apologize.
About the fruits. You were talking
the fruits, yes. There is evidence that Mr. Brody obtained the proceeds of the, well, he applied for the loans and got the checks. There's no evidence about what he did with them afterwards, whether he gave them to other, the government didn't present any evidence of bank accounts of his with large amounts of money in them. The district court at one point surmised that maybe Kareem and Pad knew that maybe he had paid them cash. She said, you know, checks aren't the only way people get paid things. People get paid in cash, too. So the district court, there was no evidence presented, let me put it that way, that he got.
But I thought the other participants in this got a flat fee.
Well, there was evidence, Ms. Harper testified, of course, her credibility being at issue, that she got either $300 or $400 for each false appraisal, depending how elaborate her falsity was, how elaborate her fraud was. She got either $300 or, if it was more elaborate, $400. Padnu and Kareem, there was no evidence or testimony or anything about how much they got or what they got out of this. They may have been, for all we know, being paid large amounts of cash by Mr. Brody. The government just didn't bring any evidence in about either one of them about what they received for this. They may have received large commissions. You got to remember, they had evidently, Harper tested, I'm sorry.
But we know he got it originally.
He got it originally. We don't know what he did with it, I think. There was some evidence that he paid a mortgage and some credit card bills, but I think that came to at most $10,000 or $12,000 out of $800. We don't know what he did with the rest. And the people who could have testified to that, Padanu and Kareem, were never. No evidence about them was ever presented. The tax preparer, initially, Mr. Brody didn't even send her the information. She got that information through another person. There was evidently, before Mr. Brody ever became involved in this, there was evidently this whole elaborate fraud network out there. To call him an organizer, leader, manager, or supervisor in this fraud network that would involve Kareem, Padanu, Ms. Harper, who had done dozens of false appraisals for Padanu, and he had showed her how to do these. It's far more likely that Mr. Brody was recruited to come in by these people to come in and do this. There's no answer to that in the record. There's no evidence about it.
About Padanu and Kareem?
Padanu and Kareem were loan officers. They had to set this whole thing up. They had to put the paperwork together, get it to an underwriter, get it approved by the lender, get it to a settlement company.
My understanding was that there was not any issue as to Padanu or Kareem.
And the being involved, I think, as one of, that's about whether there has to be five participants. She said there's no question that Padanu and Kareem, there was a discussion about whether there were five people, Padanu, Kareem, Harper, and the name I can't pronounce, that I'll refer to the tax preparer. That's what that discussion was about whether there were four other people. So it's far more likely, as I said, nobody ever heard from Padanu or Kareem. It's far more likely that Mr. Brody was recruited by them and that they told him what to do. There's no evidence that he had any idea how to do this. Ms. Harper said he called her one day. We don't know the background or the circumstances of that, but by that time she had been involved with Mr. Padnew in an extensive fraudulent false loan applications by that time. The notion, in this case, Mr. Brody did far less than the defendant did in Quigley, and there's no basis to call him an organizer or a leader of this activity that had been ongoing for a long period of time.
Is there no other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Give
Thank
us
you.
Some time.
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Manarino for the United States. With me at counsel table is Rory McLeese, Chief of the Appellate Division. Regarding the closing argument, the District Court did not abuse its discretion in sustaining the government's objection. Appellant was trying to make a linkage between facts not in evidence, namely the delay in bringing the case to trial, and he was trying to use that as some way of impeaching Harper in the course of citing many reasons why Harper shouldn't be believed. In doing so, he was contrasting the delay in bringing the case to trial, which he saw as a reason not to believe her, with, on the other side, the absence of corroborating evidence for her statement that she, in fact, named him in 2001. This was one argument that he was making. And so when the court sustains the objection, it's advising the jury that you have in front of you her comment that she named him in 2001. You don't have in front of you the idea that, well, it took a long time to bring the case to trial, and what should you infer from that? It was saying to them, you are not to consider that at all. And to
the extent correct that the rest of her charge included the standard, you're not to consider anything I say, and you can disbelieve or believe any part of it.
That's right, and there was nothing about the instruction that the curative instruction that said to them, you have to believe her on this point. And that's clear from the very next thing defense counsel said. He went on to go after her credibility in all these different ways. She's made hundreds of false appraisals. She's in cahoots with Badunu and Kareem, and they have a whole separate fraud arrangement independently of what appellant is doing with them. And she's getting she's got a 10-year sentence hanging over her head, and that's why she's cooperating. So there were many, many ways in which to attack her credibility, and this didn't inhibit him in the least in doing that. Instead, what it did is said to the jury, you are not to consider the fact that it took 4 years or whatever it was to bring this case to trial and somehow hold that against her. What you have in front of you is that she said this. He could have gone on and said, well, you still don't have any corroborative evidence on that point. There was nothing that foreclosed him from making that argument. And as Your Honor's pointed out, he didn't complain at all about the instruction that was given. And at the end of the case, when the court gave its final instructions, he said he had no objections to the instructions that were given. And instead, he went on, continued with his theme, which was attacking Harper's credibility, trying to put it on her, and he didn't in any way get held back by this. The thrust of his case was that appellant was this sort of small-time guy. He's trying to make a name for himself and build a business, and here are these grifters who are good at putting together false loans, and for some reason they decided to do all these things that inured to his tremendous benefit, but that they were really the ones running the show. And that was the thrust of his argument. Whether or not Harper named him in 2001, if it had any impeachment value whatsoever, it was minimal. Instead, his thrust was, she's a cooperator. She knows that she's got a lot to lose here, a lot more than she stood to gain, namely $300, by giving him fake appraisals. She's got a lot. If she was willing to lie for $300, what is she willing to do now in order to avoid 10 years in prison?
You know what the evidence regarding the Carteret matter was that was given to the government, given to the defense?
I don't know the precise nature of the disclosure, but as Your Honor pointed out, there was nothing to prevent appellant from exploring that further. When she says, I wasn't the person who did the false appraisal, it was done for...
You don't know what the nature... I mean, obviously the defense counsel had something that he was using to cross-examine from. Usually this is in the form of a letter or a pleading. Do you know what was in the letter or the pleading?
I don't know the specific reference that was made, but it was enough for him to latch onto this as an issue and to explore it with her. And we think the fact that he chose not to do that, instead of saying, well, okay, you weren't the appraiser, what exactly was your role in this offense? The fact that he chose not to do so shows that that wasn't really the point. The point which he made after she corrected him, the point as he saw it was, but you were fired, right? And she said, well, yes, that's true. His point was, you've been engaging in fraudulent activities. You got caught on this occasion, and you were fired for it. That was what he was trying to get at, that you've been caught doing this type of thing before. And in his closing argument, he didn't say, well, you know, Harper is not that big of a deal. Padona is really the guy driving the train because he's the quote-unquote loan officer. Instead, he lumped them together. He said, Padona and Harper and Kareem, they're all working together. They're all putting these deals together all the time, and appellant gets caught up with the wrong people. He wasn't in any way distinguishing between them for purposes of culpability or how much control they had over the operation. He was simply saying, my guy is just this innocent, small-time guy who's trying to improve himself, and these other people, you know, lumping Harper, Padona, and Kareem together, got in and controlled what he was doing. And Harper was not a big part of the government's case. If you look at our closing, we didn't talk about her at all. When we're marshaling the evidence to show why is appellant guilty, we're talking about the documents, we're talking about the experts, we're talking about independent appraisers who came in and said, look, these properties aren't worth anywhere near what was claimed in these documents. The only time we mention Harper in our original opening is to say, you know, he's trying to blame her, among others, for what went on here, but she only got $300 per appraisal, whereas he got $870,000. Who sounds more involved there? Who stands to benefit more? And in our rebuttal, we didn't vouch for her, as Amicus accuses of doing. We didn't vouch for her at all. We invited the jury to disregard her. We said, look, we didn't mention Harper at all when we were talking about why appellant was guilty. So why mention her now? This case doesn't, and the way we put it was, this case doesn't turn in any way, shape, or form on whether you believe her or not, whether you like her or not. It doesn't matter. What matters is the documents. What matters is he got the proceeds. He was making the decisions about what went down and how it went on. So we were not in any way relying upon Harper, and the idea that she was somehow central to this case, whether for purposes of the curative instruction, or for that matter, for Brady materiality, it simply doesn't apply here. And if I can shift over to the Brady question, we agree. We were required to give over this information. FBI had it. That's imputed to us. But as far as materiality goes, again, Harper simply wasn't that important of a witness to us. And when she is impeached on the Carteret information, the fact that she was fired, what appellant found important about that issue was that she got caught yet again doing another fraudulent activity. And there's no real explanation, even today. Well, why is a loan officer so different from an appraiser that it constitutes a completely different aspect of cross-examination or some new area that was never explored?
You want to say a word about what the evidence of control was?
Sure. Well, as far as control goes, first of all, as the court pointed out, appellant didn't contest that issue at all. His whole point was, we don't have five or more people here because, and his specific argument was, because I, defendant, don't count as one of the five, and that was dealt with by the court, and it's not challenged again on appeal. He didn't get into the question of was he or was he not in control. As Your Honor pointed out, the court said, well, there's nobody's contesting Padona and Kareem. And to correct Amicus's assertion, we do point out that he didn't challenge the specificity on that, and it's in footnote 12 of our brief.
What about this Quigley case?
I'm sorry?
What about the Quigley case?
We don't think Quigley answers this question. Every case is going to be unique. If there is evidence that she was somebody who recruited people and kept money, that may not be enough in a particular case. It's all relative to the other participants.
What else did he do?
What he did in this case, he was making the decisions. For example, on the settlement companies, Amicus in their reply says, well, we were making gross exaggerations when we say he insisted on the settlement company. Actually, that's precisely what the testimony says. The REMAX agent, I believe his name is Edwin, he testified that appellant insisted, didn't request, he insisted on a particular settlement company. And even when the settlement agent said to him, well, you know, actually that's not the way it works, it's in the contract that this other company is going to be involved. And he said, well, no, I have the right, I, appellant, have the right to change the settlement company, and I am insisting upon doing that. And he even writes a letter to them to that effect. So he's in many, many ways, he is making the effort to control what goes on here. He's recruiting Harper. Amicus says, well, we don't know how he came to call her. Well, that may be, but the fact is, when she was asked directly on her testimony, how did you come into contact with this defendant? She said, he called me on the phone, and he wanted to meet with me, and he told me the amount he wanted the appraisal to come out to. And Amika says, well, that other than that, he didn't have much to do with it. Well, that's kind of the whole ballgame. If he's saying what the amount is, that is the bottom line. And the fact that he's delegating to her, look, I want the numbers to come out such and so, now go ahead and make it happen, that shows that he's delegating. That shows that instead of him getting his hands dirty and getting into the nuts and bolts of it, he's got somebody working under him for a fee, granted, but somebody working under him who's going to make it turn out the way he wants. And we see the same thing with the financial person. I'll take a shot at the name. I believe it's Aiken Mirele. Nobody here to correct me, I guess. But he says to this person, give me these financial records so I can use them. He gets them. He pays a fee again, goes out, and then comes back and says specifically, this didn't work for me, though. I'm getting grief from the bank because it doesn't match up with my application. I want you to do it again, and I want you to make it come out to this particular number, to these numbers that are going to match up with my mortgage application. And Aiken Mirele then does that. He takes them and goes and does his business. So he's exerting control in many ways. He's also keeping the lion's share of the proceeds. We had one of our investigators going through his bank accounts, Mrs. Henderson, who said, I went through it. I saw that he made a payment to Bedunu for $500. He was using these funds in his personal account, using them to pay his bills, pay his credit cards, pay his mortgages. That's one of the factors that the court looks at under 3B1.1, keeping the proceeds. And that's exactly what he did here.
Can you say a word about whether the appropriate disposition with respect to the Smith claim is remand or a decision that it's just not enough to make an ineffectiveness claim?
Well, we think the record forecloses it. Appellant did not request a Smith departure, but he did advise the court that he was facing deportation at the end of this, and we understand that's not the same thing. But the court, with that knowledge, and notwithstanding that knowledge, nonetheless said, well, I'm going to give you the top of the guidelines. And, I'm tempted to go beyond that. I'm tempted to go higher, but I'm not going to do that here because I didn't give you notice. That doesn't sound like a court that is willing or would have been willing to entertain the thought that, well, he's facing deportation, therefore you should go even lower than the sentence that you believe right now probably isn't enough. Instead, the court gave every indication that if it had given him notice, it would have been going higher. And appellant's claim that, well, he's entitled to an ineffectiveness hearing on this, it can't get around that point. The district court has already made clear its view that the sentence he's getting is already quite generous and that it was tempted to go higher. And its reason for not going higher didn't turn on outside factors such as his immigration status. If the court has no other questions, we'll rest on the remaining issues.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Mr. Kramer having time? Why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to say about the control.
Save a little time for the Smith claim I wanted to talk about.
Okay, I'm sorry. If the 302, the FBI 302, which is at page 147 of the appendix, says that Mr. Brody was introduced, this is the tax preparer, was introduced to the source being the tax preparer by Dorothy Wallace, who was an employee of a real estate agency that engaged in fraud. It says the preparer prepared false documents for clients. He was introduced as a person who needed to get some paperwork done. That's not Mr. Brody directing or controlling the tax preparer to do anything. And then it says the first time the source prepared documents for Brody, Wallace, the person who introduced him, faxed the numbers to the source. Again, how the government gets control over this tax preparer or supervision over the tax preparer when somebody else says Mr. Brody needs documents and somebody else faxes the numbers to the tax preparer, it simply is totally at odds with Quigley, where the person did far more than Mr. Brody did. The Smith claim, and I cited several cases in my brief, it is routine for a defense lawyer who has a client who's an illegal alien and has pled of being convicted of an offense for which they'll be deported in every case to ask for a Smith departure. I recognize that the court said in Smith that it's not supposed to be routine, but as you can see from
a little more than that, in Smith the court said it's likely to be extremely rare and it would require factual findings about what the Bureau of Prisons is likely to do in that particular case. And there's no such evidence here. And therefore no reason to believe that a Smith claim would be accepted here, leaving aside what the government points out, which is a statement in the transcript.
Well, as you can see from the cases I cite in my brief, which this government doesn't even talk about, it is
the evidence that has come up. Four, three where it was granted, where they were asked for it.
There's millions more. I just don't want to list hundreds of cases. It's asked for in every case because the evidence has come out that BOP makes no distinction between different types of inmates who are illegal aliens who are going to be deported. They're all treated the same. They're all treated more harshly. So it is routine in the district court. Of the four cases, there's one where it was denied. It is whatever the court of this court said originally, it has become routine for Smith departures to be granted in the district court. But that's not the question before Your Honors. Before Your Honors is the question is, should the lawyer have asked for it? And that's clear.
Well, that's the first question. And the second question is whether it's likely to be prejudicial. And so you have to show reasonable probability that it'll make a difference. Right? Something like that, leaving aside exactly what that
means. Yes. No,
and,
that's true.
And what we said in Smith was that, first of all, departures are supposed to be rare, and this particular kind of departure is particularly rare, and it depends on set of facts, and we don't have any such facts. So we don't have any reason on the record to think that this is really likely to make a difference. And if you add to that the argument that the judge knew about alienage, so now if it really is routine in the district court, then the judges know that Smith is possible. I agree that that's not enough to raise the issue from a Leandri point of view, but that's not what we're talking about here. And the judge saying, I'd go over if I'd given you a little more notice. How do you deal with that?
I see the latter as, in essence, irrelevant in the sense that that doesn't say what she would have done if a specific issue had been presented to her. And all I'm asking for, obviously, is not for this court to order that she grant the Smith departure. What I'm asking for is that it go back to allow a lawyer to argue the Smith departure.
You're asking for a little more. What you're asking for is in every case in which a Smith departure isn't requested, that that's ineffective assistance of counsel, right? Every case. There's nothing special about this. That is enough to require a remand in every case.
It's enough to require a remand where there's no dispute that the defendant is going to be deported as an illegal alien. Now, the only reason there's no evidence in the record about the conditions is because the lawyer didn't put it in the record, which is the whole claim, that the lawyer didn't ask for it and make the argument that he's going to be treated more harshly by BOP because he's an illegal alien. So that's the only reason there's no evidence in this record of it, which is the whole question. I mean, that's kind of circular in the sense that the reason there's nothing is because the lawyer was ineffective.
Your point is that in every case, the defense counsel must bring this argument, and if the defense counsel doesn't, in every case, this court must remand.
I think that's right because that's what this court's ineffectiveness about the law is on guidelines issues, where you're supposed to be aware of issues that are possibilities. Let me step back for a minute.
Get the whole point out, and you can respond to it. The main case you're arguing about is Soto, right? But that is a case in which it's an adjustment, not a departure. And an adjustment is obviously different because the defendant is entitled to an adjustment, and if the court makes a mistake, it's a mistake. That's not the question with respect to departures.
No, but let me go back a minute. It will not be every case. There's cases where somebody got the mandatory minimum sentence and there's no way to go below it, a 10-year, 5-year, a life sentence where a life sentence is mandatory. So it's not in every case. I take that back. There will be a number of cases where there's no room for a departure.
Where they didn't get exactly the mandatory minimum, right?
There's a fair number of cases where they get exactly the mandatory minimum in this district because of the crack guidelines and various other guidelines. But putting that aside, I think you're right. The question is it a tactical move or is there some reason for it? There's no tactical reason not to ask for a departure that is clearly a possibility, and as it's grown up and as I've shown you in the cases, is whether this court originally viewed it that it was going to be routine, rare or not, is routine. It's routine to ask for it. There's no question about that. I don't know of any case with an illegal alien that our office has ever not asked for a Smith departure. And it's usually written in the plea agreements about the Smith departure. So to say
There's no tact, let me put it this way, there's no tactical reason the lawyer would not have asked for it, which seems to me to be the clincher in this court's and the Supreme Court's, of course, case law about ineffective assistance. If it's a strategic or tactical move, of course you can't really go behind that and question it. But there's no tactical reason not to request the Smith departure in a case like this, where there's no dispute that he's going to be deported and subject to harsher conditions. So just not to, yes, I think you're, in the end, the answer to your question is, in the circumstances where there is an availability of this and the defense lawyer does not ask for it, yes, I think it would be ineffective in every case not to ask for it if it's a possibility. Unless the
you
district
don't want to say, you don't want to say it would be ineffective. The only question is whether it be a remand, right?
Well, remand,
whether
right.
it's ineffective right. depends on whether it ends up being prejudicial, right?
Yes. I'm sorry. I meant ineffective initially in the sense of a remand. And there may be cases where the district court says, don't bother asking for a Smith departure. I'm not going to give it to you. There may be cases like that where it's obviously not ineffective. Or the district court says, I'm going to depart for some other reason and no further for anything. I mean, there may be there's obviously cases where it's not going to be ineffective. So I guess I'd backtrack again from saying that every case, there's a whole different subsets of cases where a lawyer for
scratch out my note now.
there may be cases where tactically or strategically the lawyer doesn't ask for it. This is not one of those.
Why don't you wind up?
That's all I have to say. I guess. Right, thank you very much.